Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect. Well, hello from the show. Welcome to Dialect. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners in Preston on Preston FM, no less, 103.2. Listeners in Birmingham on Unity FM, 93.5. And not forgetting, of course, Radio Verulam in St Albans. This week we'll be talking to Ryan Walker. He's a local musician. He plays the acoustic guitar. His music is a mixture of gypsy-inspired rhythm with folk and vocal styles. We'll also be getting Julian Parry's View of the Week. And Tony Gosling has some plans for the feature regarding why 9/11 might have spelt the end for the Concorde. Our roving reporter Anthea has supplied us with what seems to be an entire history of Mozambique, quite fantastically. She's on her travels in Africa at the moment. She's talking to Mario Barbito in an interview she's recorded for us about how he fought in the 17-year Civil War. We have the sixth part of Robert Louis Stevenson's Letters, read by Alec Milne. Tim Burrows will be reading us one of their poems. Jeff Sparks has supplied us with a What's On Guide and Song of the Week. He's canoeing in Peru. He can't be with us, so somebody else will be reading that out for us. Splendid. I'm John Peters Coleman. So, first up today, I'd like to introduce our guest in the studio for this week, Ryan Walker, a local musician. Hello.
Hello.
So, I recognised you when you came in, because I went to the Big Yellow Storage facility, and you used to work there, and somebody else in the studio thought, no, I recognise you, because I bought tea from you in a shop.
Yes.
So, you've been getting around. How long have you been living in Bristol?
Year and a half.
Where did you live before that?
Exeter.
Okay, so you're Bristol. Sort of a West Country lad for quite a fair time.
For a while, yeah, but I didn't grow up here.
Okay. Where are you from originally?
Winchester, originally.
Very quiet, I imagine.
Winch?
Yeah.
I'm a true product of the suburbs. So I lived about, it's about 15 miles outside of Winchester. In Chalmers Ford, which is just the suburbs. Nothing but houses.
So did you live there sort of all through your teen years?
Yeah, yeah.
What is there to do in Winchester for nightlife for a burgeoning young teenage boy? Dust bowls.
when I was that age, I looked about 12 when I was about 17, so there was absolutely no drinking to be done whatsoever. So it was, it was drinking still, but it was rather on the quiet in cathedral grounds around people's houses, really.
Okay. How long have you been playing guitar?
7 years.
Right, okay.
Maybe 8.
What inspired you to take it up? What were you listening to at the time?
At the time, what was I listening to? I was listening to a hell of a lot of rock music at the time, although I was... Dave Matthews. Aerosmith still.
Yeah.
Always. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Okay. Have you been playing in bands and stuff while you've been in Exeter?
Yeah,
or something?
Yeah, I was in Devon going to uni, so I was not in Exeter when I was learning guitar.
Right.
I moved to Exeter to play in a music scene.
Okay, so how did that go?
Yeah, pretty good actually. Yeah, pretty damn good. I moved there, I lived there for 5 years?
Right, okay. As I understand it, Exeter tends to revolve around the Cavern quite a lot, the Cavern, because that's one of the...
Yeah, played there a few times.
Only night spots.
Yeah, played there a few times.
How do you find... is it a bit of a sort of a tiny scene in Exeter? It must be quite...
It's a real...
incestuous.
Yeah, it's a musician scene.
Mm.
Every single gig you're going to play, you're going to be playing to a room full of musicians.
Okay, well, that must have its good points and bad points.
It's
a lot of bad points.
A lot of bad points.
Is it a room full of nerds going, I'm not sure about your technique
you
could have done this.
I wouldn't have done that, that's really weird. Or, no, I wouldn't have done that, I can do that so much better than him.
So how do you prefer Bristol to where you've been before?
I'd wanted to move to Bristol for ages, and I was trying to get a lot of bands that I've been in there to kind of come up to Bristol with me, because, you know, the scene here is just colossal. And, you know, you go and play a gig, and actually there will be just people there to... listen to live music as opposed to musicians or guitarists there to steal licks.
Okay, so how have you got on with musicians in Bristol? Have you got a band together or what you planned?
Yeah, I put together one band and then that flopped. So I'm just putting another one together now.
Okay, what's the sort of sound you gave? Or still sort of a rock?
No, I left all that behind. You can't get paid and play rock music anymore. Not outside of Exeter anyway. No, it's very much, it's a folky sound I suppose, but it's influenced by a lot of blues. I've always listened to a lot of blues.
Okay. What sort of blues? Because blues covers like a myriad numbers of sounds and feels.
Yeah. It's mainly in the lyrics, lyrically and in the vocal styles, probably where the blues comes in.
Okay.
And what I do. Guitar-wise, at least, guitar-wise and instrumentally, it's kind of gone quite jazzy.
It's interesting how the music scene has started to vary a bit, because obviously rock is now, according to, I think it was Billboard, only 3% of single sales now taken up by rock.
Mm.
Like, it's officially dead, we're told.
Yeah.
But there's quite a lot of gypsy and other sort of Balkan sort of sounds coming in, all sorts of random stuff.
So, yeah, absolutely.
You're listening to a lot of that at the moment. What do you think about some of your favourite bands in the Bristol scene that you enjoy?
I love Edenhight.
Yeah?
I don't know if you've seen them around.
No, I haven't. I don't know
They're
them, no.
Incredible. They're just really lengthy... funk jams. Really lengthy, no vocal, just really lengthy funk jams. They're great. They play the Old Duke. They play over in the canteen quite a lot.
Okay.
I like the Duke just up the road here. I really enjoy that place. And there's one band there that I really dig called the Blue Notes.
Okay, yes. Yeah. I think they play there quite a lot. They've got some regular, yeah. Eddie Martin and the Seven Jasmine and people like that play there a lot.
Eddie Martin's there like twice a week now, I think.
Okay, where are you playing around at the moment? Where can people commonly sort of see you playing?
I've got a meeting tomorrow down at the Left Bank to go and meet a drummer.
Okay.
So I'll probably bring a guitar and show him a song or two there. But I'm trying to break my way into the Stokes Croft, Gloucester Road kind of folky scene. There's lots and lots and lots going on there.
Right.
And there's also, I've played a couple of places in Bedminster. There's lots of like old man bars there where you can...
And the South Bank Centre is another venue.
Yeah, I've played there too. That was good fun. I met my old guitarist there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, there's lots to go. Lots of places to play.
Where do you see yourself in terms... I mean, commonly people will say, oh, well, obviously I'm looking to get a record deal, but of course you can sort yourself out, in terms of a lot of the way that you release stuff online and you can market yourself a lot. So what are your sort of grand ambitions as such, apart from, sort of having some regular gigs?
I have quite modest dreams, really. I'd quite like to just... work in a guitar shop during the day and play guitar in the evenings.
Nice.
I don't really... Because I've been in a band before where we kind of nearly made it. And I got a glimpse of the industry and all its horror.
Okay, what was your band called at the time?
The Touchy Subjects.
The Touchy Subjects. So how did you nearly make it? Did you get approached at a gig by...
No, we went through a series of auditions for different showcases for different A&R guys.
Right.
We managed to get on that. We had a manager for a while who managed to get us on that list, so we worked really hard.
Does that mean you'd sort of turn up at offices, with all your band gear and just sort of play? Or
no, they'd hire out clubs, and all these A&R guys would turn up, and there'd be loads of bands there who'd all bring, like, their groupies along, all their fans and everything, and you'd have to go along and do what was essentially a battle of the bands, really.
Right.
And,
but that wasn't for you?
Well, it was just they all wanted... Every single song had to be under 3 minutes. You can't sing about anything too risky. You can't sing about anything too boring.
Sounds like trying to tread a tightrope.
Yeah, it was real tough. I mean, they pointed at what we were wearing and said that we weren't taking ourselves seriously.
That's obviously terrible.
to be honest, I think we were wearing a lot of velvet and beads at the time.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. As if people in the '70s, when rock was very popular, did not ever do such a thing.
Well,
who's ever heard of that? Rock musicians wearing beads.
Unfortunately, it's not the '70s anymore, man.
Okay, now you're going to play us a song. So it gives a flavour of your guitar licks with. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to play the Lumberjack Convention.
I am.
Good.
The Lumberjack Convention, they had a lot to say. Meeting up in the bunkhouse to discuss their rate of pay. Boss man's bringing in machines that work as hard as 10 strong men. It's not a matter of maybe, it's simply a case of when. No one knows what'll become of the hard-working lumberjack. He's going home to Scandinavia and he's never coming back. Lumberjack Convention, old Nelson took the stand. Not many folks have been in this game as long as this old man. Problem here is economics, the wise high climber said. If we stay here in this brave new world, we're gonna end up dead. Solution, boys, is to head back home and wear our pappies lock. Cause over there, nothing's changed, but here we're treated like dogs. At the Lumberjack Convention, the decision was almost made to all jump on the next boat home after they collect their pay. The only man wanting to stay was Tommy O'Whistlepunk. Cleared his throat and stood up from his seat upon the bunk. I built my house with my own two hands and I only just bought my truck. I don't have any reason to go, but I sure wish you boys good luck. We'll be right back.
teary eye. Cause Tommy was a popular fella and no one could say goodbye. Don't worry about me, said little Tom, shaking hands with a grin. Spare a prayer for me when you're back home again. I'll keep blowing whistles these machines don't wanna hear. I'll be fine and dandy alone, so don't you fellas fear. And so after the convention, each man went his own way. Each one knew this was the end of the lumberjacker's day. No one knew what ever came of Tom and the Whistle Punk. Last time that they saw him, he was waving from his bunk. He never gave the slightest word about his future plans. And so no one knew what ever became of the very last lumberjack man.
Thank you very much. Do you have a MySpace or similar?
Yes.
What is it?
MySpace.com/BrotherWild.
Brother Wild.
With a E on the end.
Brother Wild was an E on the end.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Well, we'll hear a little bit more from you later in the show.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much.
After Banksy, it has been one of the most popular exhibitions at Bristol Museum and Art Gallery for years, apparently. Flight marked the 100th anniversary of the 1910 foundation of the Bristol Aircraft Company in what was then the Fields of Filton by Sir George White. It was the start of a tradition in this city which culminated with design and production of no less than the world's first supersonic airliner, of course the Concorde. But if you missed the exhibition, don't worry. Most of it has now been moved to the home of the Bristol Aero Collection, a charity based up in Gloucestershire at Kemble Airfield, just south of Cirencester. Our very own Tony Gosling spoke to the chairman of the Bristol Aero Collection, Oliver Dearden, at Kemble this week and asked him why, although no other aircraft crash without the type being taken out of service, the 2003 crash meant the groundbreaking Anglo-French Concorde would never fly again.
After the Paris crash, British Airways invested quite a lot of money in their Concorde. They were redesigned inside and eventually they came back into service. But Air France and British Airways, between them, had to pay for all the backup costs. That was the deal with the governments when they took the aircraft. Whilst an aircraft's in service, there's always a team back at the manufacturers working on it, dealing with faults and modifications as things go on. Now, British Airways and Air France had to pay for all that between them, on the engines and the aircraft. After 9/11, first of all, Concorde lost a large percentage of its passengers because they all worked in the World Trade Center. France did not support the United States in the Gulf War, etc. The Americans stopped flying for Air France. And Air France, we started to lose money on Concorde. Their Concordes were nowhere near as profitable as British Airways. The regular routes was London, New York. They also flew Barbados once a week in the season. Secondly, the aircraft was also getting old. Although in hours it's not, it had been flying for 25 years. And spares were becoming a bit of a problem. Now, British Airways had 7 aircraft. They only refurbished 5 when it came back into service. They used the other 2 for spares. But eventually, Air France decided that they were going to stop flying Concorde. Now, for British Airways to carry on flying, they'd have had to have borne all the backup costs, and they couldn't. Plus the fact that spares were becoming rather more difficult and harder to obtain. So in the end, unfortunately, in 2003, as you remember, Air France just stopped flying almost the next week. British Airways continued for another 6 months, but there was no commercial way they could keep it flying, unfortunately. So, sadly, it came out of service.
Do you think there's any chance we'll be seeing it in service again? Or?
No. There's no way. Once it was withdrawn from service, it would never fly again. People compare it, say, to the Vulcan, which was put back in the sky. But the Vulcan, compared to Concorde, is a Model T Ford. It was a very simple aeroplane. This is an extremely complex aeroplane, and there's just no way that you'd get it back into the air again. It will cost hundreds of millions.
Now, what about the Concorde that's actually up at Filton? Because it seems to be languishing out in a field, as if no one really cares about it.
Well, we ran the tours around it until October. It's been there for 7 years. So Airbus, in conjunction with British Airways, decided it must have some maintenance done on it. So it was closed to the public, and for the past 3 months now, they've been working on it, albeit outside. They've been taking all the inspection panels off, removing bits. They've removed all the leading edges from the wings, Concorde doesn't rust because it's not made of steel, but it does, aluminium does corrode, so it has to be treated. It's not going to collapse, but to maintain it in good condition, it really did need a few months of really good maintenance work done on it, and that's what they're doing at the moment.
But surely if it had been kept in a hangar, it wouldn't need all that looking after.
Fortunately, there's a hangar available.
We'll have to see if we can find one.
Well, that's what we've been trying to do for the past 7 years, unfortunately.
We're in a hangar here up at Kemble. I mean, yeah. This must be one of the nearest, I suppose, to Bristol. And you're still looking?
Yeah, well, you couldn't get Concorde in this hangar. It's too tall.
Right. What about yourself? What was your involvement in the industry? Because I know you worked at BAC.
Only for about 4 years in the 50s. No, I left the aircraft industry then, but always maintained an interest in aircraft. My wife and I did, and when we retired, she joined the helicopter museum, I followed her, and then we joined the aero collection, and here we are.
So can you give us an idea of what was going on when you were working in the business? Because it really was, many people would see it as a sort of heyday of British aviation in those days.
Oh, it was. If you went to the Farnborough air shows of the 50s, every year you went, there was a new aircraft. The excitement, albeit unfortunately one or two crashes, but you don't go to Farnborough these days and hear supersonic bangs, do you? You did in the 50s.
I suppose the thing is, if you're going to be at the cutting edge of aviation, there's bound to be a few crashes.
Well, yes. I mean, yeah, unfortunately, by the very nature of aeroplanes, sometimes you take a step too far. There's a problem. It's nobody's fault. They didn't know it existed. A prime example of that is the Comet crashes. The Comet went into service, the world's first pure jet passenger transport, hugely successful, two mysterious crashes. Nobody knew why for a long time until they found out this problem of fatigue, which they never knew anything about. Like all aircraft in those days, Comets had square windows and they got fatigue cracks at the corner and they failed. And the aircraft just fell apart.
A little crack would sort of actually start opening up whilst the plane was going along.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was something that was what, due to...
It's just the cycle of loading. As an aircraft flies, it's pressurised, it flies, it's flexed, it's moving. So any mechanical structure has got stresses in it which are going up and down all the time.
Well, it might sound a bit worrying, but of course your wing, as you're flying along, is actually bouncing up and down.
Yes, it is indeed. So you've got to. That's why they test it. And it's fatigue is only like a rubber band. What happens if you keep stretching a rubber band? It breaks, effectively.
Does it?
Yes, because it's fatigued.
I haven't tried that for a while.
But that's all understood now, so it's not likely to happen. But then something else happens that nobody's thought of. Fortunately, the technology, the testing is so critical today, it very rarely happens. And I mean, Concorde, as I say, apart from the crash at Paris, which wasn't really the fault of the aircraft, it was just a whole series of events, has been a very safe aircraft.
Thank you very much to Oliver Dearden for agreeing to be interviewed there, and also to Tony Gosling. Oliver Dearden, the chairman of the Bristol Aero Collection, the collection of which is based in a hangar at the Kemble Aerodrome near Cirencester in Gloucestershire. It's open in the low seasons to the public every Monday, and of course it'll be open during the summer more, and introduces one of the original Concorde mock-ups, as well as everything from an original Bristol tram to nuclear missiles and helicopters. So something to keep you entertained for hours. Our Anthea has been travelling, as ever, she does frequently. She's been in Mozambique and has interviewed a gentleman there, and she's written us a little history to sort of get us in the mood and help us understand a little bit. So this is what she sent us. It's recorded during her trip to Mozambique, and it's an interview with Mario Barbito, who is a member of the RENAMO party, that's a political party, not a booze and drugs party, from its early days of opposition to the Frelimo party, which was ruling Mozambique during the 17-year civil war that ravaged the country. It was fought between the Frelimo party and RENAMO's external backers. Recruitment by RENAMO was sometimes voluntary, but frequently by force. Villages were rounded up. Anyone with skills, teachers, medical workers, for example, were shot. Roads, bridges, railways, schools, clinics were destroyed. Atrocities committed on a massive scale. And there were further droughts in the 80s. Frelimo opened Mozambique to the West in return for aid. Political change brought an end to the war. And in the early 90s, Mozambique switched to a market economy. In the 1999 elections, RENAMO accused Frelimo of irregularities in counting the votes and boycotted the presidential inauguration, which sparked more rioting and civil unrest. So there you go. That here gives you sort of a flavour of some of the difficulties that they've been having. So yeah, you are now going to hear an interview with Mario Barbito. He was a long-standing member of the RENAMO party we've been discussing, and he fought against Frelimo in the civil war.
I'm in Teledata in Beira, and I've met a gentleman from the the left political party. Hello.
Hello.
What's your name?
Mario Barbito.
And which party do you belong to?
It's Renamo Party.
And that was the opposition party?
Yes, yes.
In the Civil War?
Yes, yes, the opposition party. And we fight against the communism, against the... We fight for the democracy on the country, and we bring it. And now we have it.
So how old were you when the war broke out?
I cannot remember properly, but from 1978, I was working on the clandestinity against the government. Yes, 79, or around this.
Why did the war start?
My point of view is because I take decision to join to RENAMO, is because the situation that we are was living in Mozambique was very bad. We have no democracy. When the Frelimo party takes the independence, they begins to create a communist system on the country, which we didn't accept that, because the woman body, woman kind, is free. You cannot put everybody on a jail. In Mozambique, we have a situation that it was a very big jail. They create a lot of re-education camp, and they take a lot of people to put there. Around more than 500,000 people die there. All the militias, they take the power and they do what they want with the people. They create forced village to stay. They
call that a concentration camp.
Concentration camp is something that to re-education. But they create also the village, which they take the people to force them to stay in this village. They call them aldea comunal, it's communal village. And they bring them one party system. And we didn't accept that.
Did they kill many people as well?
Yes, the report said you can see a lot of people, they was taken to re-education and didn't come back. Some of the opposition against the government, they killed them in a lot of re-education camp in Mozambique. But this is the past, and I think that we must look at in front. We make the peace agreement, and we finish everything. We change the history, and now we have. We are trying to build the democracy on the country.
Why are you still not in power then?
One of the reasons is your country and the foreign countries. It's not RENAMO. RENAMO is winning in Mozambique. But I think the interests of your country are more jointed to Frelimo than to RENAMO. Because always your country, when come here, they say that the election not fair, but you can continue. So it's the reason is your country. You don't forget England helped Frelimo during the war. I'm not fighting against the people of England. It's not my intention. But the truth, we must tell it. Your country and the international community are as cynical as the reason that we are not in power. The people don't want Frelimo on the power. The people want a democratic party. They used to stall the vote every time. And you agree with that. You, in your country, you agree with that. And you give money to make more damage to the democracy on the country. So I cannot understand why you are developing monoparty system in Mozambique. In your country, you are fighting for a multi-party system. So the reason that we are not in power is you. It's the international community. Yeah.
Is that because of all the money interests?
No, I think RENAMO can give better condition. Now you have better business than you have during the time of Samora Machel. More rich people. The people was telling the capitalism. Now they are the capitalists of the country. So we feel that we do something good for the country. The communists of the past, with your help, the help of your country, of the international monetary system. This is the situation we have here. But we give them the chance to do it, because at the past they have only planified system economy.
So what about foreign investment coming in, Chinese, South African? How does your party feel about that?
The point of view is not from where is coming the money. It's the way that the money comes. if you want to make a company, if you have no partner from Frelimo, your company cannot work, and we don't want it. We want you to come to make it, to create jobs, to increase our national budget, to produce goods for the people, to fight against the hungry, to give jobs, to build house. And you can see that our country, we are a rich country, but we are living in poverty forever because your country wanted it. It's your country, it's America, all the international community want us to stay living in this condition because they know that the day that we are free, we can grow very fast.
What about China and India, though? They've got big problems with poverty as well as wealth, and they're growing the fastest nations in the world.
Yeah, but they change the system in China. So it's the problem. But you don't want to help us to change country. You are supporting, giving money to fight against the people of Mozambique.
Is that the present government or the past government?
It's not the past. On the past, you send militaries from England to fight against Renamo. I think that the people of England must understand that. On the past, during the war, he was training people fighting against us. When we make the peace agreement, you change. Now you cannot support the people to train militaries against Renamo, but you are giving man to help to destroy Renamo, to create a system of monoparty system in Mozambique. It's not a speaking of somebody of opposition. I'm speaking what happened on the country. It's true that the military from England, they train people against the Renamo.
Going back to the war, why did the civil war go on for so long?
It was very difficult to finish this war. First of all, the international community, he knows that Mozambique is full of natural resources, and the international community wants to keep it as much as possible. If they keep the war running, they can give job to the people there. They can send a no-government organization which takes more than 70% of the money they send to the country. $1,000 they send to Mozambique, $600 go back to the country. They give job to the people. They come to here, people, to do something that Mozambican can do. But the money is given. In the end, you must pay $1,000, but $600 go. Is the reason that it takes so long, it's the two sides. On the beginning, the international community was told that we was supporting the apartheid system. But I didn't go to the war. I didn't help Renamo to take the democracy to the country because South African, I never met any South African. I went because the situation in Mozambique was very bad. I cannot stay here. I must join the Freedom Party or die. So to die, better to die on the bush. Yes. So the reason that it's taken very long, it's at this time they have the problem of America and Russia, and the Soviet Union, and also the Cold War or something like that. It's name in English. The people of Mozambique, they make the resistance. And the resistance was done with all the ways.
Is it stronger in the villages, in the rural areas?
During the war?
Yeah.
I cannot tell that only in the rural areas because the last time of the war, some weeks before the peace agreement to be signed, we was fighting around the Beira. We was fighting around Maputo in Costa do Sol. People, they didn't move. So the military influence was in all the country, from a village to the big cities. The influence of administrative system is a little bit less than the military influence.
The original leaders,
the leader of Renamo,
who directed the war, are they still alive, or what happened to them?
No, Andre Matsangaisa, the man, the beginning, the first president, he died during the war, and after that, Mr. Jagama take the power, and still we have the Mr. Jagama.
What percentage of the vote do you have now?
It's very difficult to tell you because we have not the real figures. The figures that you can see on the official way is not the truth. So I cannot tell you how much.
Do you think you'll be successful at the next election?
Depends the way that the international community wants our country. We have winned all the elections and the Frelimo has stolen our vote, and you close the eyes. Your country and other countries, they close their eyes. Okay, no problem. It's Frelimo. Let's stay there. Until one day. I think that the situation is going to change. Soon it's going to change.
Thank you very much to Anthea Page and that very in-depth discussion about Mozambique there. Thank you very much. It's now my great pleasure to introduce an orchestral stab, followed by Julian Barry, who you'll remember from previous weeks. And, of course, he has his view for the week. And this week is no exception.
Well, hello. This week has seen some turmoil in the political world. We started off with Tunisia, where the president eventually fled. We moved to Egypt, where the president eventually fled. And now trouble is rising in Algeria. Across the Arab world, the good people are trying to establish democracy and overthrow tyranny. And they are going to some lengths to do it. Here in Britain, of course, we take democracy for granted. Although, whether we've got true democracy or something else that masquerades as democracy is another matter. I remember some years ago, a very famous politician, Lord Hailsham, who also rejoiced in the name of Quentin Hogg, delivered the Dimbleby Lecture on the subject, the elective dictatorship. And when we review the years Tony Blair was in Downing Street, perhaps that was one of the finest examples of elective dictatorship this country has ever seen. As a direct result of those years, and of course the fact that the Liberal Party now form part of the coalition, we are now to be asked our views on proportional representation, the AV, the alternative vote. For those listeners who are not quite clear on what happens when you cast your vote, you also cast your preferences for second and third choices. And when the votes are counted, those who are not in the top two or three, they are discarded and their second preferences on those votes are reallocated. And so eventually a winner emerges. Whether or not it's a good system remains to be seen. Many criticise it because, particularly Israel is a good example, it leads to extreme parties holding the sway of balance. And all they have to do is to stand in the middle of the seesaw and get what they want out of the system. And the mass majority, who out there really want peace, suddenly find that they're not getting what they thought they voted for. So the question is, what's going to happen? Well, on May the 5th, you're all going to be asked to vote on the proportional voting issue at the same time that council votes go out, when a third of council seats come up for re-election. But a couple of weeks ago, there was a sudden move made in the House of Lords where the motion was passed, not by a big majority, but it was passed, that unless 40% of the electorate vote for a change to proportional representation, then it will not count. Many, of course, look upon this as a completely cynical event because, of course, only about 30% of people vote in local elections. For my money, I say let them have first past the post, but under Parry's method, the rolling referendum. Under my method, political parties would be paid by the people on the basis that he who pays the piper calls the tune. The Electoral Commission would hold the money voted by Parliament every year, very public, very transparent, and that money would be distributed amongst the eligible parties on the basis of the number of votes they had taken at the election, not the number of seats. Of course, there is one caveat, or there are two caveats, in fact. One is that all electors will be allowed to go into a post office at any time, take a little piece of paper, write to the Electoral Commission and say, this is my voter number and I want my money to go to such and such a party. And they could do that any time. So that any party that actually brought in, as a member of government, a policy that was very unpopular would suddenly find all its money going out of the coffers. It wouldn't be that it was just losing its money from the coffers. It would be being given to its political opponents. And that would really concentrate their minds. And of course, here's the big one. They wouldn't be able to take political donations from the public at the same time that they took private ones. So that would give us the rolling referendum. And I think that that would be a much better idea than proportional representation, which you're not going to get anyway.
Well, thank you very much to Julian Parry and his thoughtful mind therein inside that head. Thank you. And let's hope you have lots more interesting thoughts and come back next week.
I will be here.
Hooray! Right, let's go back to Ryan Walker momentarily for a bit more music.
This is Arlo Guthrie's Coming Into L.A.
Coming in from London, from way over the pole, flying in a big airliner, chicken flying everywhere around the plane. No, it couldn't be much higher. Coming in from Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags if you please, Mr. Customs Man. There's a guy coming in from Mexico. No, he couldn't look much stranger. Walking in the hall with his things and all, smiling like he was the Lone Ranger. Coming in from Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags if you please, Mr. Customs Man.
Ryan Walker. Now, here is Alec Milne to read the sixth part of the selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest Mahieu. The music that you hear is Duff, performed by Concerto Caledonia.
The selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 6. Summers in Scotland and Winters at Davos, August 1880 to September 1882. Stevenson, Fanny and 12-year-old Lloyd, still known as Sam, arrived in Liverpool on the City of Chester on the 17th of August 1880. Colvin travelled there specially and was the first to greet them on the quays of the Grey Mersey. They then joined Arliss's parents, and Colvin had lunch with the united family. He reported rather cynically to Henley, "I dare say it made things pleasanter my being there, and I'm bound to say the old folks put a brave and most kind face on it indeed." It was too soon to tell yet how he really was, in the face looking better than I expected and improved by his new teeth, but weak and easily fluttered, and so small you never saw. You could put your thumb and finger round his thigh. On the whole, he didn't seem to me a bit like a dying man in spite of everything. It would have done, and it will do, your heart good to shake hands with him again. When I had him alone, talking in the smoking room, it was quite exactly like old times. And it is clear enough that he likes his new estate so far all right, and is at peace in it. But whether you and I will ever get reconciled to the little determined brown face and white teeth and grizzling, for that's what it's up to, grizzling hair, which we are to see beside him in the future, that is another matter. Stevenson's parents, accompanied by Arliss, Fanny and Lloyd, reached Edinburgh the next day and stayed at the Palace Hotel before leaving for a holiday in the Highlands. In spite of the background of family distress against which the marriage had taken place, the Stevensons treated Fanny with great kindness and affection. She soon made a conquest of her father-in-law and was thereafter treated indulgently like a favourite daughter. Fanny's letters show how genuine was her own affection for them. Fanny did not make as good an impression on Stevenson's friends. At their first meeting in October 1880 in their London hotel en route for Davos, her main concern was to try to prevent them overtiring her husband. She was, as she wrote to her mother-in-law, "all the time furtively watching the clock and thirsting for their life's blood because they stay so late." The next 2 years were spent in a vain search for better health. 2 winters were spent in the Swiss Alps in the health resort of Davos, and 2 summers with his parents in Scotland. In 1881 in Pitlochry and Braemar, and in 1882 at Stobo and King Ussey. Despite chronic illness, they were years of growing success as an author for Stevenson. He wrote many of his finest short stories, including Thrawn Janet and The Merry Men. He saw through the press 2 volumes of collected essays, Virginibus Purusque and other papers, and Familiar Studies of Men and Books, and his first volume of collected stories, New Arabian Nights. At Braemar in 1881, he began to write his most famous and popular work, Treasure Island. To W. E. Henley, 24th of August, 1881, Braemar. "My dear Henley, of course I am a rogue. Why, Lord, it's known, man. But you should remember I have had a horrid cold, and I have been in a rather blasted state since syne. Now I'm better, I think. And see here, nobody, not you, nor Lang, nor the devil, will hurry me with our crawlers. They are coming. 4 of them are as good as done, and the rest will come when ripe. But I am now on another lay for the moment, purely owing to Sam, this one, but I believe there's more coin in it than any amount of crawlers. Now, see here, The Sea Cook or Treasure Island, a story for boys. If this don't fetch the kids, why, they have gone rotten since my day. Will you be surprised to learn it is about buccaneers? That it begins in the Admiral Benbow public house on the Devon coast. That it's all about a map and a treasure and a mutiny and a derelict ship and a current and a fine old Squire Trelawney. And a doctor, and another doctor, and a sea cook with one leg, and a sea song with a chorus, yo ho ho, and a bottle of rum. At the third ho, you have to heave on the capstan bars, which is a real buccaneer song, only known to the crew of the late Captain Flint, died of rum at Key West, much regretted. Friends will please accept this intimation. And lastly, would you be surprised to hear, in this connection, of the name Routledge? That's the kind of man I am, blast your eyes. 2 chapters have been written, have been tried on Sam with great success. The trouble is to work it off without oaths. Buccaneers without oaths, bricks without straw. But youth and fond parents have to be consulted. August 25th. And now, look here. This is the next day, and three chapters are written and read. Chapter 1, The Old Sea Dog, or At the Anbro Benbow. Chapter 2, The Black Dog Appears and Disappears. Chapter 3, The Black Spot. All now heard by Sam, F, and my mother and father, with high approval. It's quite silly and horrid fun, and what I want is the best book about buccaneers that can be had, and the later bees above all, Blackbeard and Sich, and get Nut or Bean to send it skimming by the fastest post, and now I know you'll write to me for the sea cook's sake. Your Admiral Guinea is curiously near my line, but of course I'm fooling, and your Admiral sounds like a sublime gent. Stick to him like wax. He'll do. My Trelawney is, as I indicate, several thousand sea miles off the lie of the original or your Admiral Guinea. And besides, I have no more about him yet. But one mention of his name, and I think it is likely, he may turn yet further from the model in the course of handling. A chapter a day, I mean to do. They are short, and perhaps in a month the sea cook may to Routledge go yo-ho-ho in a bottle of rum. My Trelawney has a strong dash of lander, and I see him from here. No women in the story. Sam's orders. And who so blithe to obey? It's awful fun, boys' stories. You'll just indulge the pleasure of your heart. That's all. No trouble, no strain. The only stiff thing is to get it ended. That I don't see. But I look to a volcano. Oh, sweet. Oh, generous. Oh, human toils. You would like my blind beggar in chapter 3, I believe. No writing. Just drive along as the words come, and the pen will scratch. RLS, author of Boys' Stories. To W. E. Henley, Braemar, 19th September 1881. Dear Henley, with a pig snout on, I am starting for London, where I likely shall arrive on Saturday, if still alive. Perhaps your pirate's doctor might see me Sunday, if it's all right. I should there lunch with you and she, who nearer to you than you are to me. I shall remain but little time in London, as a wretched clime, for not so wretched for none are as that bloody old Braemar. My doctor sends me skipping. I have many facts to meet your eye, my pig snout now upon your face, and I inhale with fishy grace, my gills out flapping right and left. All pin, Sylvester, I am bereft of great deal of charm by this. Not quite the bull's eye for a kiss, but like a gnome of olden time, or bogey in a pantomime. For ladies' love I once was fit, but now I'm rather out of it. Where'er I go, revolted curs snap round my military spurs. The children all retire in fits and scream their bellowses to bits. Little I care, the worst been done. Now let cold, impoverished sun drop frozen from its orbit. Let fury and fire, cold wind and wet, and cataclysmal mad reverses rage through the federate universes. Let Lawson triumph, cakes and ale, whiskey and hock and claret fail, tobacco love, and let us perish with all that any man could cherish. You it may touch, not me, I dwell too deep already, deep in hell, and nothing can befall. Oh, damn, to make me uglier than I am. RLS.
That was Alec Milner reading the selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Our own Malcolm Grieve will be reading Treasure Island shortly, so this is sort of a build-up to that. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the studio. It's time for us to open the little cupboard in the corner of the room and drag out our poet of the week. He's here, Tim Burrows. Hello.
Hi. So this week it's an eco-conscious poem, so it's called Tired with the Toil of Wondering. We are tired, tired with the toil of wondering. We seek to escape in a world of rest, of screens that do not challenge, of reams that do not speak with words. Words, direct words, words of guidance in a shifting sand of bigotry. Bigotry that sucks down till the ear can hear no sound, till the tongue is dry with sun, chapped lips creating its own silence, so to speak. The muttering the muttering that cannot be heard, but feel the shuddering, the trembling breast, the ribcage that cannot convulse as our earth does, but hides from the bite of knowledge, the knowledge of the fall, its fall, as we fall, with the pips of destruction falling from the jaw that does not speak, from eating too much of the pap, not knowing, not caring that the mother is dead, stone dead, from the endless, selfless giving to the self that does not know the need for giving.
Thank you very much, Tim. I always feel as you walk away from your post as Poet of the Week, we should find a little snippet of Goodbye Pork Pie Hat. Well, Jeff has prepared a What Song Guide and given us a Song of the Week, but he's not here, so I would like to introduce Alita to read it. Hello.
Hello. Okay, so this is the What Song Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday the 25th of February, Magazine Gap will be performing with the support of Jacanda at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance and £7 on the door. Also on the 25th of February, Discharge will be performing with the support from DEFCON Zero, Bullet Ridden and also Smiler at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Now on to Song of the Week, and I present Marmaduke Duke. This group formed in 2003 and to date have released two albums. This is from Duke Pandemonium, which was released in 2009 and is the track titled Everybody Dance. Was Marmaduke Duke with Everybody Dance from the album Duke Pandemonium. For more information, you can check them out on www.themarmadukeduke.com. On Saturday the 26th of February, Nearly Dan, who are a tribute to Steely Dan, will be performing at the Fiddlers in Willway Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. Finally, on Sunday the 27th of February, the Celebration Jazz Band will be performing at the Old Duke in King Street, Bristol. The gig starts at 12:30 p.m. and entry is free. I've been Alita. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Alita, and thank you to Jeff. Well, that's all from Dialect this week. Thank you very much to our studio guest, Ryan Walker, for having a chat and singing some songs. Thank you to Julian Parry and Tony Gosling. Our feature was from Anthea Page. We had the letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, read by Alec Milne, and Tim Burrows treated us to some poetry. Jeff Sparks wrote the What's On Guide, and Alita read it, and the studio engineer was Michael Noyce. The producer was Michaela Dennis. If you would like to listen again or catch up with any of our previous shows, you can find us on dialectradio.co.uk and, of course, on the Bristol Community Radio website, bcfm.org.uk. It's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman, and we'll have a bit of Ryan Walker to play us out. See you all next week. Goodbye.
This next tune is called It's Just Your Foolish Pride. When I was a boy, I discovered the joy of living my life day to day. And now I'm a man and I understand that life is just a game to play. There's always a girl who can give me a place to stay. I came by your town when I was down on friends, luck, money and food. You were the sweetest thing that I could buy with a wink. I didn't care if no one approved. It's not in my power to change your point of view. So we stole out of there just as soon as we're dead. I bought the tickets with your mama's pearls. One hand on your waist and one in your purse. I showed you a bit of the world. I was your man and for a little while you were my girl. We had a great time and I didn't mind having you along for the ride. It wasn't love that we were thinking of. There's no need for you to cry. No question of blame or a matter of shame. You don't have a thing to hide. It's time to go as you belong at home. It's just your foolish pride, my pretty baby. It was a great fling, but like all good things, our time together came to an end. I wanted to roam, so I sent you home. Now the money had to run out again. And despite your tears, I'm sure we parted as friends. I had a great time, no, I didn't mind having you along for the ride. The honky bone sent you home, now that I couldn't really decide. No question of blame or a matter of shame. You don't have a thing to hide. It's time to go, cause you belong at home. It's just your foolish pride, my pretty.